Reading the Riot Act, a podcast. I'm Rachel Rogers from the University of Toulouse-Jean Jaurès. First episode, The Gordon Riots of 1780. On the 2nd of June, 1780, as the war to retain the American mainland colonies wore on, a rally was convened in St. George's Fields, a sprawling green space in London's Southwark, across the Thames from the Houses of Parliament in Westminster. The gathering was called by the Protestant Association, a pressure group led by Scottish MP Lord George Gordon. In 1779, it had successfully campaigned to oppose draft legislation which would have relieved Catholics in Scotland of certain penalties. Buoyed by the success of those efforts, which led to the Scottish Bill being dropped, the PA turned its attentions to England, where a Catholic Relief Act had already passed in 1778. The measure had revoked the 1703 Act for Further Preventing the Growth of Popery, which, among other things, had banned Catholics from bequeathing land and property to their descendants if a Protestant could make a claim to it. The relief measure had appeared to many on both sides in Parliament as a reasonable measure, designed to relieve Catholics of anachronistic restrictions and conveniently allow them to enlist in a British army in desperate need of reinforcement in its struggle against the American colonists. Yet staunch opponents of the Act denounced the measure as an infringement of the King's coronation oath to uphold the Protestant faith, and orchestrated a petitioning campaign which mobilised support among a number of ordinary Londoners who saw Lord North's ministry as deaf to their complaints, preoccupied as it was with the ongoing American crisis. The PA had anticipated numbers for the rally and decided to organise the march into four divisions. They also determined on a resolution in May of 1780 that the magistrates of London, Westminster and Southwark are requested to attend, that their presence may overawe and control any riotous or evil-minded persons who may wish to disturb the legal and peaceable deportment of His Majesty's subjects. The spectre of popular excess had therefore been factored into the day's preparations. The procession descended on Parliament, where some MPs were cajoled as they entered Westminster. Amid the turbulence, debate on the petition was adjourned until the following week. That evening, disturbances began in the streets of the capital. There were attacks on the property of prominent Catholic residents, foreign embassies were sacked, and nightly assaults on property took place all week across the city, intensifying from the 6th of June when Parliament once again refused to debate the repeal of the Act. The principal prisons of the capital then came under attack, their inmates released and furniture within taken out and burnt in pyres which lit up the night sky. The mansion of the Lord Chief Justice, the Earl of Mansfield, a Tory minister, was also targeted. On the 6th of June, a royal proclamation was issued by the King, George III, authorising a military response to suppress the rioting and restore order, wresting control for the management of the crisis from the local City of London authorities, who'd been widely criticised for failing to quell the violence. It's estimated that around 300 Londoners, possibly many more, were killed in the military clampdown before the unrest subsided from the 8th of June onwards. In the following weeks, many of those detained for their involvement in the rioting stood trial at the Old Bailey or before the Grand Surrey Jury. 25 of the 62 sentenced to death were eventually hanged across the capital at the very sites of their offences. Lord George Gordon was arrested on charges of high treason following the riots and stood trial the following year. But, expertly defended by Thomas Erskine, he was acquitted by the jury. Labelled the Gordon Riots after the PA president, the events are widely seen as one of, if not the most important urban protests of the late 18th century.
I've come to the British Library in London's King's Cross to speak to Ian Haywood, Professor of English at the University of Roehampton. Ian has worked extensively on political caricature and the visual culture of the Georgian period. His most recent book, Queen Caroline and the Power of Caricature in Georgian England, is about to come out with Palgrave Macmillan. Along with John Seed, he edited a collection on the London riots of 1780, the Gordon Riots, Politics, Culture and Insurrection in Late 18th Century Britain, which came out with Cambridge University Press in 2012, and he's agreed to speak to me about the Gordon Riots. Thank you very much for joining me, Ian. London experienced week-long disturbances in June of 1780 after MPs in Parliament adjourned debate on the Protestant Association petition calling for the repeal of the Catholic Relief Act. Do you think that this was an important issue for ordinary Londoners?
Well, that's a good point. I guess judging by the amount of support that Lord Gordon, George Gordon, and the Protestant Association seemed to muster, let's remember that the petitioning was a way of expressing popular support by actually having a crowd go to Parliament with the actual physical document, this petition, this address, which we think had about 40,000 signatures. So that's a substantial amount in its own right, isn't it? This was the kind of organised element of this campaign to repeal the Catholic Relief Act of 1778, which, as you probably already explained, was at one level an attempt to recruit Catholics into the British Army, which was busy fighting America in the American Revolutionary War. And possibly there was an element of social justice in there as well, but that was probably the minority reason for lifting some discriminations against Catholics. So 40,000 marchers, you know, quite a substantial amount, but they picked up many more apparently as well on the way to Parliament. So if we just go by sheer numbers, which is you know, one way of, isn't it, of judging the popularity of a cause is by the numbers of people who turn out on the streets. But the other thing to say, I guess, is that anti-Catholic prejudice was, of course, by this point woven in to not just British politics, but I guess you could say into the political imagination, even into the idea of Englishness.
Yes.
And this is problematic for us now, of course, isn't it? Looking back, you know, from, let's hopefully, a more tolerant age. But at this time, you know, we'd had the Reformation all the way back in the 16th century, obviously, and, you know, the rejection of Catholicism then, how important that was for this sense of English identity as a Protestant nation. We'd also had, the removal of one of the British kings, James II, in the so-called Glorious Revolution. That was 1688, 1689. And the Bill of Rights, all these were seen as, you know, sacred symbolic moments in this idea of English liberty. And so the idea of, you know, discrimination against Catholics as we'd see it now wasn't necessarily seen that way. It was seen as part of, wasn't it, the kind of fundamental British constitution. And the third element, I'd say, is that this attachment to a notion of liberty, which was seen as fundamentally Protestant, doesn't necessarily mean that people were, you know, anti-Catholic in any kind of sense that they really understood Catholic religion or it was a kind of religious hatred. I think, as many historians have argued, anti-popery, as it became known as, because one of the chants at the Gordon Riots was, you know, no popery, no wooden shoes, you know, etc. That kind of stereotyping was part of just this more generalised notion of what liberty meant and what the absence of liberty meant. So, you know, the old enemy France was seen as not just a threat to Britain, you know, because we're always fighting wars with France over territory and so on. But France was also seen as part of Catholic Europe and therefore synonymous with a kind of tyranny insofar as Britain was a more advanced country democratically. It had a constitutional monarchy. It didn't have obviously full voting rights, and that was a bone of contention for the next more than 100 years. But nevertheless, Britain was proud of the fact that relative to some of these, many of these European countries, which were ruled by Catholic monarchs and were more autocratic, you know, the association of Catholicism and tyranny was just kind of made. So any move to relieve restrictions on Catholics in Britain could be seen as an infringement or opening the sort of, you know, opening the door to a more autocratic method of government. So the government itself was being judged as, you know, undemocratic, even though in fact, by current standards, you know, this could be seen as a liberal move, couldn't it? As rights, you know, as advancing civil rights.
For many ordinary people of the city then, introducing an act to give Catholics more rights could have been seen as a transgression of age-old liberties dating back to Henry VIII's break with Rome. Dana Rabin has argued, in this sense, that some of those backing the act in Parliament viewed the measure as what she terms strategic toleration, in keeping with broader attempts to ensure the successful integration of new territories, particularly Catholic Quebec, ceded by France at the end of the Seven Years' War, into the expanding British Empire. Pro-relief MPs such as George Savile, who had taken the bill through Parliament and who saw themselves as enacting an expedient and cosmopolitan measure, did not anticipate such an outpouring of anger, especially since the law had already passed in England and the Anglo-Irish ascendancy remained quiescent. Yet, it was the success of the campaign to halt Catholic relief in Scotland, where mass protests had broken out in 1779, which galvanised the Protestant Association, prompting them to take the fight back to England. Ian Haywood again.
You know, Scotland actually managed to stop the introduction of the Act.
Yes.
By taking action, didn't they? And there was rioting in Scotland in the previous year. And it was because Gordon was emboldened by that experience that he then brought his experience to London and insisted, didn't he, against, in some ways, the better judgment of the PA, Protestant Association, that they should go out on the streets in their mass numbers because they were nervous about could he keep control of the crowd.
As well as deep-rooted anti-Catholic sentiment, there is also a sense that some broader antipathy to those in authority and the exercise of the judicial power of the state may have been at work in 1780. Ian Haywood has written about the importance of the second phase of the riots, when buildings targeted changed from sites of Catholic worship and property of leading Catholic residents of the city to symbols of state power and oppression. The major prisons of the capital, the home of the Lord Chief Justice, the Earl of Mansfield, and even the Bank of England.
I've often wondered, you know, had we not had that second phase, had it died down, you know, after, say, if Parliament had agreed to debate the issue on the 6th of June, so sort of 4 days in, would we have the same... Would the Gordon riots have gone down in history, you know, in the same way as this extraordinary, you know, sort of unprecedented kind of urban disturbance? And clearly, in one sense, no, because the level of destruction went up exponentially, didn't it? Mm. But I think what you're saying is even more important, that the motives, such as you can deduce aims from popular violence, which is a tricky thing, isn't it, as we know as historians, you know, because obviously they're not declaring their aims in a kind of obvious way. I mean, you know, when they go out and destroy properties and so on. But such as we can judge what was going on, I've used the term, and I'm not the only one, that there was a kind of quasi-revolutionary element to this. Because, as you say, it was now symbols of power, state power. State power. It was no longer a religious bigotry or targeting simply Catholic sites of Catholic worship and, you know, and prominent individuals associated with the Catholic Relief Act, like Lord Mansfield, you know. Sadly, when, by the way, it's a little side issue, but when Mansfield's house was burnt down, and all his papers were burned. That included, apparently, papers about the famous judgment he made on slavery.
Right.
In the 1770s, and that's a huge loss.
Yes, it's part of his library that that went up in flames.
You know, so that's, you know, the kind of irony there, that this great moment of advancing freedom, you know, in the history of British slavery, with its complexities, we've been denied access to his papers because they went up in flames. That's right. So I think that this moment of like 2 or 3 days where, you know, he had Newgate burnt down and, you know, he had attack on the Bank of England, if one thinks about that, you can't get in a way more revolutionary than, apart from attacking the palace, you know, the monarch. Mm. Now, they never did that, as far as I know, you know, although the violence was called by one commentator a Republican frenzy, and I think that's an interesting phrase, a Republican frenzy. They never went so far. They didn't step over that line, you know, going for the actual monarchy. But the attack on the Bank of England is fascinating because I've often thought to myself, okay, suppose they'd actually have succeeded in storming the Bank of England and let's say even plundering the Bank of England, but what then? You know, what were they actually? So this raises this question for historians, doesn't it, like ourselves, of looking at this evidence. How much of it is symbolic and how much of it is a kind of quasi-military or militaristic kind of tactic, you know? It's just that the Gordon riots, one of the things I'd like us to talk about is just the scale of it was so extraordinary, wasn't it? The speed and the scale of it, that it really was. There's so many testimonies describing it as like apocalyptic, you know, like the whole of London's on fire, you know, and it's like some dreadful judgment day, you know. So I think this is what puts it in a different league, isn't it? But whether or not that was intended by the rioters is another matter, but that's certainly one of the effects.
I'm in Bloomsbury Square in the London Borough of Camden, just down the road from the British Museum. In the centre there's a park, a small quiet haven amid the bustle of Great Russell Street and Tottenham Court Road. And it was here at about 10 or 11 o'clock at night on the 6th of June, 1780, that the townhouse of William Murray, Earl of Mansfield, Chief Justice of the King's Bench, was targeted as part of the city-wide disturbances. According to witnesses who testified at trial, furniture, including a desk and trunks, were thrown out onto the street and set alight amid shouts of no popery in one of the many blazes lighting up the Capitol over the course of that week. Windows were smashed and items such as copper pots, books, petticoats and bed linen were stolen. Lady Mansfield and her household were evacuated to Lincoln's Inn Fields, a 10-minute walk away at around midnight. The assault continued through the following morning as milling crowds looked on. A certain Elizabeth Timmings stood trial for theft later that month in relation to the assault on the Mansfield residence. The Old Bailey records from the 28th of June session read that Timmings was indicted for stealing 5 china dishes, value 20 shillings, 5 china plates, value 5 shillings, a linen sheet, value 8 shillings, a linen napkin, value 10 pence, a pair of leather gloves, value 1 shilling, and a muslin cap, value 2 shillings, the property of the Right Honourable William, Earl of Mansfield, June the 6th. Mansfield was seen as the representative and most visible symbol of Britain's harsh penal system, which meted out punishment to those accused of theft, highway robbery and other misdemeanours across the capital. One rioter, Charles Kent, was convicted for his role in the destruction of Mansfield House and was hanged on this very square in July 1780.
Letitia Holland, a 20-year-old woman convicted for the same offence, was also sentenced to death by the Second Middlesex jury. She was respited on the eve of her execution, having received a royal pardon and sentenced to 2 years hard labour.
William Hayter was found guilty of unlawful, riotous and tumultuous assembly for his role in the destruction of a house on East Lane on the 7th of June. The jury nevertheless recommended Hayter for mercy. The following exchange appeared in the Hampshire Chronicle on the 17th of July. When the prisoner was taken from the bar, Justice Buller requested to be informed by the jury upon what grounds they recommended the prisoner to mercy. Their foreman answered they grounded their request on its not appearing that he'd been active in pulling down, that he was drunk and had a good character. Upon this, Sir James Eyre said that he would be foremost in recommending to mercy, but thought the prisoner an improper object, as he had started two very dangerous principles. First, destroying property on account of their religion, and secondly, propagating levelling doctrines in saying no man should possess more than £1,000 a year. I wonder then whether George Rude's view that ordinary working men took part in the protests for, as he put it back in 1956, a deeper social purpose, a groping desire to settle accounts with the rich, if only for a day, can still guide our understanding of the motivations as well as the background of those rioting. Can the riots be viewed as a moment of material or even class reckoning? Ian Haywood.
At some level, I think yes, insofar as we do have evidence, as you've suggested, that some of the targets, you know, were things like the toll booths on bridges, wasn't it? You know, and that's taking you into the area of sort of traditional symbols of sort of class power. One of the interesting features of urban riots in the 18th century, which I'm still thinking about and have written about again recently, is this choreography. Firstly, the discipline involved, as we know, it wasn't a kind of anarchic riot, because as we know, the rioters would allow surrounding buildings to be, you know, the fires to be put out by them, but they were keen that the building they really wanted to burn down did get burned down. Yeah. So there was an amount of control, wasn't there, and discipline and order there. By the way, there were no attacks on people. There was harassment and intimidation and like forcing them to give money, you know, to the cause, etc. But there were no killings, intentional. And I think it's again worth reminding your readers that at this time, offences against property were capital offences. So all this destruction of property, yes, it's terrible, but they weren't killing people.
It seems, therefore, that it was material wealth that was the target of popular violence, rather than the wealthy themselves. One local newspaper, the Derby Mercury, reported on the 21st of July 1780 that two of the men executed for their crimes, Jonathan Stacey and George Staples, had been unaware of the risk they were running by taking part in the riots. Stacey was about 24 years of age, by business a watch finisher, had a very good character before this very unhappy affair, and was led into it by a strange infatuation, which he could not account for, declaring he did not know the danger his life was in at the time. Staples was about 36 years of age, bred a teapot spout maker, but of late years followed the occupation of making and selling muffins. Declared also that he did not know the consequences of joining the mob. These poor men prayed in a most exemplary manner all the way from Newgate to the place of execution, and never once took their eyes from their books, but when they lifted them to heaven for mercy. I asked Ian whether it was realistic that those tried for their involvement were unaware of the risks they ran.
It seems unlikely to me, doesn't it, to you, in the sense that, as we know through the work of Vic Gatterall and many, you know, many historians now, the so-called Bloody Code, you know, Britain's from the present day, quite shocking, you know, level of capital offences, the number of capital offences for offences against property. Now, they weren't always invoked, were they? We know that. But they were on the statute books, weren't they? So in theory, you could be, you know, you could be hanged for stealing a handkerchief or something. But certainly destruction of property. So these the hangings that took place at, you know, Tyburn Tree, etc., around the country, took place, I think, every 3 months. So, I mean, you know, there wouldn't have been... And they were public executions, of course. So the idea you wouldn't know, because, I mean, they were taking place in front of you every few months. It seems a bit unlikely, unless you're talking about someone from a very sheltered family that had never been in trouble with the law, possibly. So certainly, I think her name, because I have the list in front of me, it's in our book.
Yes.
Elizabeth Collins, I think, wasn't it? Who's described as a domestic servant. Apparently... This is a really moving story, isn't it?
I don't know about
that
story.
She was in tears.
Okay.
She was absolutely terrified as she was being taken to the gallows, as if she didn't have a clue, really, what you know, what she got herself into.
And she was quite young, wasn't she?
17.
She was 17. Yeah, like a number of the of those sentenced.
Definitely three of them were only 17, you know, which
some were respited, weren't they? Some of the younger, those who were sentenced, I think a few of the 14, 15-year-olds who were sentenced to death.
I think that's down to... who you had on your defence team, don't you? Because apparently, in the prints, the caricature prints, that one of the famous, if you like, or notable features of one of those prints is two black men involved in writing now. So I've been asked in the past, do we know much about them? Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. We have their names, John Glover and Benjamin Bowsey or Bowsey. Now, I have to confess, there's actually an error in this book, because one of my colleagues refers to them being executed. They weren't executed, were they?
They were respited.
They were respited, but that's because they had, you know, influential people, former, you know, their masters or, you know, etc., were prepared to... So I think, you know, to some extent it comes down to, doesn't it? But yes, you're right. I mean, there were 25 executions, and it could have been a lot more, couldn't it? So, you know, to that extent, you could say it was relatively... relatively lenient if you think being hanged for destroying property is justified at all. Just going back to your point about the bourgeois property, though, I just want to put in to the discussion, because it's still something I think thinking about, this kind of choreography of riots. What rioters were doing, and they'd been done it before in the 18th century, is this sort of ritualistic burning of the property. The what was inside the buildings, wasn't it, was thrown out into the streets or
from
carried
the
out from the windows, famous scenes, and then sort of ritualistically burned on a pyre, you know, like a bonfire. And there's scenes of people dancing in this very kind of carnival way around this, and like you say, there's one image of a painting going on to this bonfire. Now, at my most sort of literary, or my, you know, thinking as a kind of scholar of art and literature and culture, it's almost like the crowd is saying, we reject, you know, the sort of bourgeois mode of representation, you know, which of which the painting is probably one of the sort of classic expressions. We are gonna start again. It's what we might think of as iconoclasm, isn't it, in a very spectacular way. We reject your way of seeing the world, you know, and this includes your books. You know, your whole mode of visual and print, you know, representation in print. Now, that's one way of looking at it as a very revolutionary thing. The other way is absolutely chilling, because scenes of book burning, as we know in subsequent history, oh, well, not even subsequent history, scenes of book burning are very uncomfortable, aren't they, for us now?
And actually,
whether it's the Inquisition,
exactly,
or whether it's later history, you know, 20th century history.
And even in, makes me think, just as you're mentioning that idea of book burning, one of the symbols of the rejection of some of the radical thought, we were talking about Thomas Paine earlier, the book burning of Rights of Man as well, only
and
a decade
effigy
later.
Burning,
and effigy,
you know,
burning.
And so all you can say, I guess, really, is that effigy burning and these kind of symbolic acts take place on both sides, if you like, don't they, of the political divide. Thank you.
A short walk down the road from Bloomsbury Square, where fires raged through the night of the 6th of June outside Lord Mansfield's townhouse, is the British Museum. The museum's Montague House building first opened in 1759, only 20 years before the London riots. And the museum's website states that at first it was only well-connected visitors who were given bespoke tours of the collections before access to the museum widened from the 1830s onwards. It's here in the museum's collection that a number of engravings and prints depicting the riots are held. Some of these prints were first published in 1780 and 1781 by Paternoster Row printers Fielding and Walker in the immediate aftermath of the riots, and represented a destructive mob made up of men, women and children setting fire to the flagship prisons of the capital, watched on by bystanders whose active involvement in the destruction is left to the viewer's interpretation. Paul Sandby also produced a series of prints depicting the army barracks set up in different locations around the capital, including Hyde Park and the gardens of the British Museum. Another victim of the destruction was Ferdinand Schomburg, who lived on Woodstock Street, just off Hanover Square in the heart of Mayfair. New Bond Street Tube Station recently opened here, a stop on the new Elizabeth Underground line, and the area is home to luxury cafes, boutiques and office spaces. Construction workers mill around next to people out on their lunch break, and an ice rink has been put up in the park in the middle for the run-up to Christmas. A drawing by Edward Days depicting the daily bustle of carriages and comings and goings on the square was reproduced in print by Robert Pollard for the Marquess of Carmarthen in 1787, only a few years after the riots. The print, held by the British Museum, purports to convey a typical scene on the square 250 years ago. A boy is seen carrying a rabbit, while a man walks past cajoling a pack horse. Two other men struggle forward, weighed down by heavy bundles, and a horse-drawn carriage is shown transporting a gentlewoman sitting alongside the coachman. A woman pushes a wheelbarrow full of what may be apples, perhaps on her way to market. A girl can be seen with her back to us, carrying pails of what might be milk or water, under the burden of a yoke, while a couple strolls by and a young child plays hula hoop in the street. Carts and carriages trundle past, and the Church of St George's, today under reconstruction, can be seen at the far end of the square. On the night of the 7th of June 1780, however, the square would have been a hive of activity, with rioters, onlookers, and those seeking to quell the violence mingling together. Servants of local dignitaries were out and about, gauging the threat posed to their employer's property and delivering messages. Schomburg's house, just off Hanover Square, was attacked around midnight. In a typical pattern now, his belongings were thrown out of the window and property destroyed in a blaze outside the front door. Anne Thomas was a servant in the Schomburg household. She later identified two of the men she believed she'd seen. Like many servants, Thomas was a key witness for the Crown in the trials at the Old Bailey. She testified to having seen a certain Enoch Fleming armed with an iron bar who'd insulted her in a threatening way while sitting on one of the beds. She also identified his brother, John Morris, as being amongst the intruders. The two men, Fleming, a basket maker from St Giles's, a poor district of the city who had a wife and four small children, and who claimed to have got into the house to rescue a child, and Morris, his 15-year-old brother, who'd gone to St James's School and who a character witness described as always a sober, honest boy, were indicted for unlawful, riotous and tumultuous assembly.
Both were sentenced to death, although Morris was eventually respited, unlike his brother Fleming. Another boy, Richard Foster, aged around 14 at the time, was also found guilty, but recommended for royal pardon. 9 years after the Gordon riots, in July of 1789, the Bastille was stormed in Paris, and by August of 1792, a more popular revolutionary movement resulted in the trial and execution of the King, Louis XVI.
Do you think there is a danger in reading the Gordon riots retrospectively through the lens of French revolutionary events a decade later? Is that a danger, or is that a necessary way of seeing and lens through which to see the Gordon riots?
Well, we argue in this book that it's quite salutary to put the Gordon riots correctly as a sort of precursor of at least the reception of the French Revolution, insofar as, I'm not saying it influenced the French Revolution. I mean, I don't know enough about that in terms of personnel and quite how the French viewed it. I mean, there's certainly plenty of print and visual material there if they wanted to consume that. But, you know, the symbolic centre of the riots, the burning down of Newgate, which is the scene that is, if you like, I don't want to say celebrated, but certainly, you know, commemorated in these prints, and that Dickens, of course, you know, makes a centrepiece of his account in Barnaby Rudge. That is the storming of a Bastille, and it was seen, it was called a Bastille at the time. So if you want to see the Bastille, you know, there's a kicking off the French Revolution, you already had this precedent. But I think you're absolutely, but so in some ways, seeing it through the French lens of the French Revolution can be sort of empowering if you want to see the Gordon riots as at least potentially some kind of revolution. But that can also be a big mistake because, as we're just saying, it was a much more kind of complex and nuanced event that maybe never was, in fact, in any sense a revolution that we would, you know, we would recognise as a concerted effort to overturn the existing regime, you know.
And perhaps it took on its own energy. Do you think that that's something that could be argued, that in terms of the panic and the anxiety that it prompted within those who were looking on or who were hearing about the events and those who heard what was going on in the street, it seems to have had its own sort of vital force as well?
Yes, I do, and I think if anything, you know, what a lot of historians have argued is that it may well have ensured that there was never going to be a revolution in Britain, having sort of got a taste and a smell and also hearing, because we shouldn't underestimate, you know, noise in riots. You know, I think it's just as terrifying as a sight. Having got as close as they want, you know, sort of as close as you could to what an actual full-blown revolution might look like. And the analogies were back to the Great Fire of London, you know, when London's burnt down, or back to the Civil War, or even back to the Peasant Revolt. I mean, all these, you know, historical precedents were made. Probably the ruling class or the people with power and influence thought, well, we're certainly not having any of that, you know, and that may have then influenced how when the actual French Revolution comes along, and there's the English, you know, its influence over the English political scene. Radicalism was a determination that we're certainly not going to have that here. So, you know, but it's a kind of turning point in that sense. Absolutely. I wonder if we could, the furthest we might go is to say that there was a sort of determination to punish the government or something like this. You know what I mean? A for prosecuting this war against America. You know, which was seen as a kind of, you know, almost like a civil war in a sense.
Yes.
You know, but fought across the Atlantic, wasn't it? And how dare you do that to our sort of friends and colleagues and, you know, people in America who were all, mainly, not all, but a lot of them were Protestant. And then we're also going to have a go at you for all these injustices that have sort of built up over the years. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. I suppose a lot of people would have been coming back from the front, would have been coming back into civilian life, or would have been under threat of being posted into the conflict still in 1780, that there was no respite to that conflict by before 1782.
Yeah, I don't know if they wouldn't have seen the end of it, would they? And again, Nicholas Rogers in the book makes a point that probably not many people know, is that just 6 months earlier, there had been some quite big riots in London in support of Admiral Keppel, who was, you know, an admiral who initially said he wouldn't fight against the Americans because he didn't believe in it, like Admiral Cartwright, like John Cartwright, the famous radical, wouldn't do it either. But he would fight against the French when they came in, you know, behind America. But he lost a naval battle, and then he was put on trial, wasn't he? He was court-martialed. And this was seen as terrible, you know, the government actually prosecuting, you know, this admiral, who was, in fact, a man of virtue. And so when he was acquitted, there were some quite big riots, you know. So there was already a lot of unrest, as you can see, and there were crimping riots, you know. And what's the other one? When you force people into the Navy.
Impressment.
Impressment. So all these were very unpopular, yeah, weren't they?
I'll maybe just finish with just a final question that I've been thinking about as I've been walking around London these past couple of days. As I understand it, the radical reformer Thomas Spence struck a commemorative coin of Lord George Gordon after the events in the 1780s, or at least I've seen on, I think it's on the British Museum collections, a commemorative coin.
Like a token,
of,
yeah.
A token yeah, coin of George Gordon. And I did wonder, are there any sort of vestiges of the Gordon riots and those events in modern day contemporary London, in the buildings, in the squares where those blazes took place, and that was seen in the visual culture of the time? Are there any references to that, any vestiges of those events in contemporary London? Do we see?
Well,
as we walk around the city.
I'm not aware of any, you know, and I don't think you've
seen any. I haven't spotted any.
And I think I remember when I was, approached to be on Melvin Bragg's show in Our Time a few years ago, and the initial kind of preparatory discussion, I was asked about the legacy of the riots, and one of the things I pointed out was this sort of contradiction between the impact at the time, which was extraordinary, and you know the records we've got, which are very spectacular, like the prints, you know, and these eyewitness accounts, and the scale of destruction was extraordinary, and yet somehow it was quickly eclipsed, probably by the French Revolution, or was it was a kind of embarrassment, you know, that you don't, you know, you don't, in a sense, you want to kind of bury the significance of what people going out on the streets can actually do, you know, if they set their mind to it. But no, I mean, if one thinks of, for example, let's say a comparison with the Reform Bill riots of 1830-31, you know, if you go to Bristol, which was the worst of the riots happened in Bristol in 1831, you go to Bristol Cathedral, there is a plaque there, you know, saying,
"Oh right,
this is where the mob, as it describes,
is that
it,
word
no,
used?
Yep.
Okay.
Broke into the chapel and destroyed the library." This mob, of course, was comprised, a lot of them were middle class people who were annoyed that the Reform Bill was being blocked, weren't they, by the bishop?
Yeah.
You know, the bishop of Bristol had voted against it. So there's, you know, there's a remembrance of that, but I can see why, because, you know, that's all about glorifying, isn't it, idealising the reform.
Democratic progress, in some ways.
Which in a sense is the end of this phase that we're talking about, isn't it, from the mid-18th century, you know, where there was this, you know, campaign for political reform, which in some ways culminates in, you know, in the Reform Bill all those years later. Although, of course, the Reform Bill left out the working class, didn't it, as we know.
It's,
and then
you
get Chartism.
Yeah.
You get the next phase of radicalism, that's right. But no, it's very interesting. I mean, even these prints, I think one of them's in the Museum of London.
Displayed?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so.
Because a lot of the British Museum prints aren't on display, are they? They're in the collections, but you can't see them walking around.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, Gordon himself becomes thought of as a kind of madman, doesn't he? And he converts to Judaism, and he dies in Newgate. So, you know, his trajectory, you know, again, sort of lends itself to this idea that the riots were were a kind of, you know, uncoordinated, rather kind of mad explosion of popular protest, isn't it?
Which is, I suppose, again, what comes back to the use of the term the mob, which still has credence, right? We still use that term in scholarship.
Even Thomas Paine, today. You mentioned earlier, in Rights of Man, refers to the mob in the context of the Gordon riots, doesn't he?
Yeah.
As simultaneously sort of deluded, you know, unqualified in a sense to be participating in politics, but also manipulable, aren't they?
Yes.
You know, they're easily
by
sort
leaders.
Of led on by, you know, by the people who obviously then get away with it, the people higher up, don't they?
And
they
George Gordon always, did, in a way, get away with it.
For a while, although he becomes a kind of parody of himself, in a way, or a kind of caricature, doesn't he, of himself, you know, later.
Thank you very much.
No, pleasure. Yeah.
During our discussion, Ian Haywood mentioned E.P. Thompson's notion of the moral economy. In a 1971 article, Thompson argued that riots were not an uncomplicated or spontaneous reaction to hunger and distress, but rather occurred when traditional rights or expectations related to food prices, supply, market practices were seen as violated, relieving working people of their obligation of deference. This, in his terms, was part of what he called the moral economy of the poor, an outrage to these moral assumptions. Quite as much as actual deprivation was the usual occasion for direct action, Thompson wrote. In a similar vein, historian of the early modern era, John Walter, has suggested that protest in the 16th and 17th centuries over food prices and availability or access to common land, the sort of protest that could still occur in the 18th and even 19th centuries, was tolerated by the authorities so long as there was no semblance of a challenge to the state or its representatives. It seems that this relative tolerance towards outdoors protest began to wane from the late 1700s onwards. In his book Riotous Assemblies, Adrian Randall sees this as down to a conjunction of factors. Britain was an industrialising nation, witnessing unprecedented urban growth, which raised new issues of how to maintain public order in cities. And the war to retain the American colonies also gave whole new meaning to the notion of rebellion. Responses to the riots were shaped by the ongoing conflict, and the riots were themselves seen as part of, or at least through the lens of, this unprecedented challenge to the existing constitutional order. It would also have been of utmost importance in 1780 to reassure the alarmed, propertied residents of London who fled their homes and sought refuge during the nightly assaults of the first week of June, that defence of property was the government's number one priority. Few legislative measures were taken, however, in the immediate aftermath of the Gordon riots to quell dissent or prevent public meetings. This, in contrast to the following decade, when, alarmed by support in radical and artisan circles for the French Revolution, William Pitt's ministry clamped down on the writing, editing, publishing, printing and selling of any text deemed seditious, and introduced measures to restrict gatherings. Whether there was any deeper revolutionary intent to the riots remains difficult to establish, but once the French Revolution had begun in 1789, the events of June 1780 were certainly seen in a new light. The potential inherent in the events of 1780 for popular revolutionary momentum to have gathered would perhaps only become fully apparent to Britain's ruling elite retrospectively, when the assault on the King's Paris residence in August 1792 led to the eventual fall and eradication of monarchy, and as radical redistributive and egalitarian measures were implemented. Viewed through this lens, London's propertied residents, as well as those in political power, may ultimately have felt they escaped relatively unscathed. Into disarray, and I must take the blame. A half-hearted word, a broken promise. That is really all your offers. Is it really all you're offering me? And if all it takes.
faces in the and the mention of her name to drive you off the rails. Temptation, will I survive? I'm sure I will. The temptation is rife to fall.